On today's episode of Family Flowers Only, I speak to Claire Walsh. Claire is from Kildare. She is a free diver, year-round sea swimmer, and teacher of breathwork courses. She's also the author of her book, Underwater. She lives in Dublin with her husband, Booty. Having both discussed early on in their relationship their desire to expand their family by having children, they had plenty of dreams and hopes for the future. Unfortunately, getting pregnant isn't simple or a given, and like thousands of others, Claire sadly has navigated the living grief and loss that comes with subfertility, commonly known as infertility, and the challenges of IVF. We spoke about searching for a space to fit in, to grieve the losses that she feels, about the IVF process and the uncertainty for the future. I hope this episode is helpful to you and that you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Claire. How are you?
I am delighted to be here. Small bit nervous, but ready to go.
Good.
Sleeves rolled up, ready to get stuck in.
We were just conversing outside the bathrooms there and we had half the podcast done.
Exactly. So I need to get the microphones on.
You're a talker, which is great. So am I. Mm-hmm. I obviously first came to know of you on our lovely pal Sheila Sholga's podcast, Ready to Be Real. You did a wonderful interview. My God, I was so taken by that. Obviously, you talk all about your career. You are a free diver.
I am indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was in a past life, I think.
The most impressive thing to me is what your record of holding your breath underwater for just shy of 6 minutes.
559, yeah.
559.
Yeah, like, I won't lie, it's a good number, but to give people a scope of what's possible, I always give the world record for women, which is 9 minutes and 2 seconds. That's, and I watched the video of that dive, and Natalia's the diver's name, and she brings her head up and does the surface protocol, which is an okay sign, and then that's it. No bother to her. It is incredible.
Hey, so, listen, you were only 3 minutes shy of that. That's pretty good too. Like, I mean,
I'll get there.
30 seconds would be good for me. That's incredible. Incredible. Do you still do it?
Not at the moment. You know, there are plans, but many of those plans take me out of Ireland. And for the moment, I think I have a bit of momentum here. And for years and years and years, I've kicked that can down the road and just gone, you know, feck it. I'm going to go off travel. I'm going to go off free diving. So I'm trying to, you know, put down roots here, work on my career here. And obviously, you know, the kind of subject of this podcast is extend our family. And they require us to remain in Ireland. And they're a pretty big focus. So the super thing with free diving is, you know, you can do it at any age. And I think it's to have that trust and that faith, which can be hard when you love it and miss it, is that it's not going anywhere. You can still return to it and it'll be there in a stage for when you're ready for it. I'm not ready for it at the moment.
I was just going to say that when you feel the call for it, it's always there. Yeah. It's nature, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I feel the call for it all the time. I dream it. I dream about it so often, but I know the timing isn't right. And I think the thing about free diving is your body has to be in alignment with your mind, and my mind is in 749 different places at the moment. So it'd be so cruel to try and harness it and shove it underwater. That's such a stressful thing to do when it's just not ready. So trust in that whole process thing, and trying to go with the flow.
Yeah. What you're here, obviously this is a grief podcast, and so much which I really want to get into is the non-traditional grief. You know, we think of grief obviously as the death of a loved one. But that is not where grief ends and begins. There are many different forms of grief, and not so unlike what you're talking about. For you, there is something very deep, like the deep ocean and under the surface. And for you, that topic is infertility and the grief associated with that. So, you know, I suppose I'd love to maybe go back a little bit and chat to you about so far,
when you first kind of you're married to mm-hmm. Boody. I got it right. And so I guess, you know, were you guys always the family, having a family, was that always a dream for both of you and something yeah. you both discussed?
Yeah. And it's something we both discussed from very early on. And when I say early, we're not going out that long. Mm. We met in 2019. He moved to Ireland in end of January, start of February 2020. We moved in together because we were just friends. I declared vehemently to anyone that would listen. And I had been kicked out of where I was living. Sorry, not kicked out, but, you know, received that notice, 1 month's notice, selling up, so on and so forth. And that had been like my third, fourth house in the same number of months. So there was a bit of a scramble to get somewhere. And Boody needed somewhere as well. And he was finding it difficult to get any responses to his emails. His full name, or his name that's contained in his email address is, and I still will say it incorrectly, by the way, Abdurrahman Talat. If he's listening to this, he's just rolled his eyes.
Hey, Booty.
Yeah. So we one evening we sat down and I said, copy and paste this. You send this and I'll send the exact same thing from my email address, clairewalsh@gmail.com, and Booty Talat, whatever. And I got a response. He didn't. And that was the way it went.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the name indicated maybe someone not Irish. So, like, it's really funny because thinking about this in retrospect, like, what was just about to come, like, a month later, we felt an urgency. Obviously, it was nothing to do with, you know, lockdowns that were imminent, but we did feel a sense of urgency. So, you know, we were just so glad. And to be fair, there's a third person that was supposed to join us. We were just so glad to get viewings. The viewings were like a game of the Hunger Games. I remember being crowded in this ensuite and I could feel the person's breath on the back of my neck. We were all shoved in here and we were all vying for the same apartment. And then I'd probably see the same people at the next viewing and the next and the next.
Wow.
So it's absolutely wild. Went to see a three-bedroom place in Bray. It was a little bit further out than I had wanted, but it was beside the sea, and that was a huge draw for me. A little bit more expensive, but it was three bed, so look, come here, we'd figure it out, that kind of thing. And we got offered it. So, you know, and you need to let us know in the next 30 minutes. Everything was so urgent. So I said to Boody, do you want to take this? And he said, yeah, look, just let's go for it. And I said to the other person, and they couldn't, it was too far out. So I said, look, we'll take it and we'll figure it out. And I think the next week, Boody was starting his job that he'd come over for. And the following week, he was sent home. And then we were into COVID territory. So, you know, our relationship, it doesn't extend over years and years and years. But, you know, as I said earlier, I insisted we were just friends. Boody is 11 years younger than I am. He's from Egypt. He is Muslim. So, you know, our growing up, our culture, our beliefs are really, really different. And I was, I don't know how old I was, minus 37 at the time. And I just, I won't say that I was impatient, but I was impatient with him. Kind of thought, there's no way that what you want and what I want can align up. And I have no interest in messing around for a year or 2 years. Like, I want to find a partner and one that I could possibly have a family with, or sorry, extended family, have children with. And I really resisted us for a long time. And so much of our conversations, like if he, I won't say he wore me down, but if we got to that point where I was finally open to a discussion, the discussion was always about, this is all well and good, us, if we were to go out, get married, and have children, what would that look like as an Irish person, brought up Catholic, compared to an Egyptian man brought up Muslim? You know, being Muslim is a big part of his beliefs and his identity as well. So it's really funny. We found ourselves arguing over these hypothetical children. It was so emotive. But I felt like there's no point getting into it and then 3 years down the road, then arguing it out. I just thought, if we're going to do this, I'm going to do it now. And it's almost like a contract negotiation. Oh gosh, they long, drawn out arguments would have to go away and take a breather because they just were so, you know, you're talking about your childhood, your beliefs and what you want to bring forward. And then when it's so different to someone else's, trying to find a place where that could meet in the middle. I remember one afternoon, it's like a Sunday, we're in lockdown, can't go very far. So I stormed out, I'm like, I'm going to do a lap of the apartment. Now, we have a perfectly good park beside us, but it sounds a bit more dramatic to, you know, penance to do a lap of the apartment block. And it was over. If we had a girl, would we get her ears pierced immediately? I didn't want that, but he does in his culture. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. So, yes, there had been loads and loads and loads of conversations about having children, probably prematurely. But I felt to move forward, we needed to do that. There's no point getting into something and then realizing that fundamentally you want very different things. So we did a lot of that hard work straight off the bat. And now we find ourselves in a position where, I won't say we wasted our time. I still think those conversations were really important and kind of good at setting up how we would work as a, I suppose, an interracial couple, for want of a better phrase. But, you know, we're now at a juncture where we might never meet these hypothetical children. And that is so, so stark to even just say out loud that it might just be the two of us.
Mm. So much for me, when I was thinking about this conversation today was a lack of understanding. And with that sometimes comes a fear for me. You know, the first time before I discuss anything, I think, oh, I don't want to say the wrong thing, whatever, which is what society does, which is why we're having this conversation today, is educate. But literally, as you're talking there, instantly I can understand or begin to understand the grief because these children were in your head. I know you're saying, using the word hypothetical, but you were fighting for your child before they're even here.
Absolutely.
Which is what everyone does. Yeah. Actually, it's a dream. And it's instantly I can feel the build up of course, there's so much loss.
Yeah.
Of course. But it's unfortunately so many people don't understand it, or unfortunately it's not recognized, and therefore there's no space and there is no, it's invisible. It's invisible. Mm. That grief is invisible. So my goal talking to you today is bring that into the forefront, you know, and have it recognized. But, you know, just, I'm getting ahead of myself there, but just, you know, instantly as you're talking to me, I'm like, okay, it just makes sense, you know, those conversations. And so for you guys then, when you came to a place of agreement, you've obviously then, you know, moved in.
Oh, we'd moved in.
Oh, you'd moved in already.
We'd moved in months at this point.
Yes, you had.
We did everything backwards.
So you got married then.
We got married in May 1 year ago. We had our wedding almost 1 year ago. It's coming up to our anniversary. Again, Boody, if you're listening, the date is the 30th of November. Put in the calendar to order Claire flowers. So we're coming up to 1 year. You know, it's really funny. I met my in-laws after we got married. We went out to Egypt January of this year, and there's a whole gaggle of nieces and nephews. And what was the most interesting was, so I don't speak Arabic. I know a couple of words at this point, but certainly can't follow it at that rapid fire pace. And they don't speak much English. But going into that family dynamic, it was noisy. It was chaotic. The kids were climbing, bouncing off walls. It was so familiar. It's like Sunday dinner in my house. It was just the most comforting thing to see. Like, do you ever watch like your favorite film and then you hear it dubbed in a different language? You go, this is so weird. weird, but yet I get it. And yeah. So it felt like our family dinner at home, like the Walshes, which is loud and boisterous and can give you a headache and wonderful all at the same time. And here it was, people look different, different language, different decor, but it's so familiar. So his family is very much about the kids, the noise. He will be very close to his nieces and nephews and would have been very involved in their lives. And still does. There's voice, you know, I'll always hear him FaceTiming the kids and, excuse me, we send them videos. And similarly, like my siblings, my two sisters have 4 children between them now. And there's another one on the way. So, you know, at the heart of any of our get togethers or celebrations are the kids. And, you know, there's a really weird feeling of wanting to contribute to that. You know, there's that part of me that's curious to know what a half Irish, half Egyptian child would look like. God love them. Their eyebrows are going to be one big thick black line across their face, the mix of the two of us. So, you know, you have all this kind of image and, you know, I'm just, you know, laughing, you know, when you said the hypothetical children, like our biggest argument was over names. Booty loves Arabic names. I love Irish spelt names. So throw an LDH in there backwards and a B as well, just to confuse things. I love them. Meanwhile, he can't even get near to saying it. And he, you know, loves the traditional Arabic names and he'd suggest one and I'd say it in a strong Dublin accent. Said, that's what they're going to be called. Mo, Mohammed. You know, I said, do you want that for your child? Do you? Do you? So like this has kind of been like a running joke for 2-3 years now. And, you know, again, speaking of hypotheticals, oh, when we have kids, X, Y, and then we'll continue on. And it was recently I said, I think we can stop saying kids at this stage. And that was a real like, the air left me. I don't really think he noticed. We don't process things in the same way. But that realization of kids might be totally off the table. So now we've kind of had to change tack and go, okay, maybe there will be a kid, but kids, whew. That dream or that hope or that image, I think that's gone. And again, you know, like I am bang smack in the middle of this messy journey at the moment. So it is fresh, it is raw, it changes from hour to hour. I was a different person when I left Wicklow this morning to where I am now, and it'll be different by this evening. It is changing so quickly. But I looked up the definition of grief about 6 weeks ago because I needed something to describe this myriad of feelings. And, you know, I didn't want to say the wrong thing. I didn't want to take ownership. I didn't want to associate myself with grief if I wasn't allowed. Because I think it is for people when they've just died and not sure. And I don't, I wanted to do it the right way. So I had to look up definitions. Like, it's so bonkers. Mm-hmm. Like, you're desperately searching for a space to fit into. And I think that's been the predominant difficulty or challenge in this, is there's no space. And like, I invited myself on this podcast, let's be clear.
I was very happy. I took that up like that.
I invited myself on pretty much. But for anyone listening, Kathy had put up a thing in your stories. I'd followed for a long time and listened to a couple of podcasts. You put up something in your stories saying, you know, what would you like to hear? Who would you like to hear from? And I asked for myself, do you have anyone talking about the grief around infertility or subfertility? And you said, no, actually. But I asked because I needed it. I needed to go, I need to hear someone who's talking about even something close to what I'm feeling now. I need a space for me and these feelings.
And you weren't finding it?
No, weren't. Amend. Like, it's still a present tense. And recently, you know, we had some not good news and we're going through a really rough time and I'm experiencing these wild side effects that are, you know, doctors don't know what to do with me. And I spoke to, it was actually my counsellor, and she said, oh my God, Claire, like the amount you've been through in the last 4 weeks even, you know, if that was someone else, if it was a slightly different context, people would be queuing at your door with casseroles. And at the time, I kind of brushed it off. And then in more ragey moments, I've just screamed, like, where the fuck are my casseroles? I don't even really know what a casserole is, to be dead honest with you. But I just want, like, I don't need food brought to my house. But it's a recognition. It's something. And that, I think, is what I'm craving, or what a lot of people seem to be craving when it comes to this area. You know, I shared about, like in very broad strokes, to be honest with you, the experience rather than specifics is how I put it on my Instagram about 2 weeks ago. I'm still going through the messages. There are hundreds of them of women, again, space, who are yearning for a space to either not necessarily tell their story, but tell their experience and how lonely that felt.
To see themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But you know, that's across all areas of anything you can imagine. If you can't see it, you know, from sexuality to race to violence to whatever it is, if you cannot see yourself represented, then you feel massively alone.
Yeah.
And that's an issue and that's a problem.
Yeah.
And before we came on, I was looking at some things on Instagram. And of course, in America, they're fantastic for highlighting stuff like that. But it is a bit slower in Ireland, which I might get into with you. But somebody had wrote down that they were feeling hopeless, hopeless, despair. These are the words I wrote. Hopeless, despair, alone and brokenhearted. And I was thinking, those are the exact feelings of someone who has lost a person. That is grieving in the traditional sense that we all come with the casseroles for.
Yeah.
If I was to ask somebody, how do you feel? I feel hopeless. I feel despair. I feel alone. I feel lonely. I feel brokenhearted. I feel horrific.
And it comes in waves.
Sadness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And loss. I feel so much loss and heaviness. All of those things.
Tick, 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 tick.
Exactly.
Tick, tick, tick.
And yet, you have to zip your mouth, possibly. I'm not saying anyone tells you to do that, but that's what the society is kind of dictating.
That's what
we don't talk about
it.
Yeah. Not to mention the stigma, which we'll get into later, or the unnecessary comments.
Yeah.
But it comes from a lack of understanding. It comes from a silence, and it comes from, I suppose, just taboo around it too then. And why would you think that is? Like, why do you think it's like that?
I don't know. I don't have those answers. Mm. You know, I think I've dealt with taboo for mental illness for years and years and years. And I have a much kinder and compassionate approach to it now, to those people who say well-intentioned, but what can be detrimental things. So, you know, I have distance, I have space, I have perspective from that. I don't necessarily have it now. And I, at the moment where I'm at, where, you know, that stage we're in, I meet it with frustration, I meet it with anger. And I find myself, A, chastising myself or being chastised by someone. Ah, come on, they meant well. And you're kind of going, that's all well and good. I can accept that. There is a part of my brain that goes, okay, that's fair enough. But why should I stand here and listen to that when I know that comment is going to put me in bed for the day? It's going to tear me down. And that is my reality at the moment. And, you know, when you were listing out that, you know, array of emotions, and I said comes in waves, like that is the other element of it. You know, I can speak at a conference to 650 women and the next day be in bed heartbroken. It comes in these unexpected tidal waves that can knock you over. So, you know, this well-intentioned, but they want the best for you, or, you know, this kind of thing, please God, it'll happen now, come on. I know you have to, come on now. I know, my friend, and you're just kind of going, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. And like, gosh, that does sound so harsh, but it's being stuck. It's being stuck in that place where, you know, rational Claire that isn't pumped full of hormones, Claire that hasn't just gotten so used to going into a clinic, stripping off, legs up in those therapy things, and like that's her every second day. You know, when I'm not that Claire, I can take a charitable approach and think, look, they meant well. What they said was absolutely arseways. They couldn't have gotten it any more upside down. But I do respect that they meant well. Because I'm not that girl. I'm so compromised. I'm so stressed out of my bin. We have so much financial worry. I'm physically battered. Hormonally, I'm topsy-turvy. And not to mention what my poor heart is experiencing. So when you're pushing everything through that really thick filter, all I want to say to someone is, shut up and give me a casserole. You know, like it's a really hard place to be in. And also, I don't want to smack someone in the face with my anger. And I think that's where isolation comes into it, which obviously compounds loneliness. But I know there's like a ferocity to my energy quite a lot, and I can be sharp or snappish when maybe I don't intend to be. But that's because you're working, you know, you're working not even at a baseline. You're working at whatever 30% of your capacity. And I don't want to be harsh to the people that love me or more importantly, who are trying. They are trying. But that's it. There's this massive gulf between where you're at and people being able to reach you. And I guess if I go back and compare it to the framework of caring for someone who has a mental illness, it's just as difficult to try and reach them and not be able to. There's just as much sadness, as frustration, as that sense of impotence of wanting to but not being able to say the right thing. It's equally as hard being the carer or the family or friends as it is being the person who's going through it. Mm. But right now, I don't have it in me to apply those same rules because I'm putting out too many fires.
It seems to me like when you say, you mentioned the word anger a lot there.
Mm.
But I feel that kind of what I'm feeling from listening to you is that it's like you're being silenced, not intentionally.
Mm.
As people would love to tell you.
Yeah.
They mean well. But no matter what, that's what we're here to talk about, is there is a silence. People either don't know what to say. They don't understand. And so if you're unable to get that grief out, that living grief, you know, because...
Where does it go?
Where does it go? And of course, it's compounded into anger. And, you know, what I was saying to you earlier there about grief and about loss and all of the, as you say, tick, tick, tick.
Mm.
Anger is massive.
Mm.
When somebody dies, there's an awful lot of anger. OK. You have your anger and rightly so. But it's almost a sense of you're not allowed to.
Yeah.
Well, there's a fear that you're not allowed to. I think for the average, you know, person who, like you, let's rewind where you said you looked up grief to see were you allowed to fit into that category, right?
Yeah.
So somebody who's feeling angry or feeling sad or feeling lonely or feeling despair has to sort to see, I don't know if I'm allowed to feel this way.
Mm. Let me check your credentials.
But each person is allowed to feel whatever emotion they want to feel. But it's when it's not recognized widely, perhaps by close family and friends, it might be, but it's not widely recognized. And that's a huge problem.
Yeah, I actually think you've hit the nail on the head, to be dead honest with you. And as soon as you said the word silence, the word space came back into my head. The reason being, I think it's the opposite. So there's silence and then there's space. And when I say space, I mean holding space.
Yeah.
Give me a space. Mm. And it's not dissimilar to the room that we're in. You know, it is a space, a physical place for me to say, to let it out. Don't correct how I'm feeling. Don't tell me that I am wrong. Don't try and wrap it up in a bow. I call it happy ending it. Don't try and happy ending it. Just sit. Just sit in the space for a limited amount of time. I appreciate you can't stay in here with me the whole time, but for the length of a cup of tea, can you sit in the uncertainty and the messiness of that moment? And the answer is very few people can. And I say that and I can hear, I think, what sounds like a judgment, but I also know when the situation is flipped, that instinct to want to solve, to want to comfort, to want to make better, and you know, it's almost worse to hear the pain of a loved one than deal with your own. So I get all those impulses. So it's not a judgment or necessarily a criticism, because I still want to do that. And I can hear myself going, okay, but maybe if you, oh my God, I'm doing it too. You know, so I do it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side of that, I just want someone to sit and go,
That's shit.
Rob Delaney, his book about losing his son, and I listened to a podcast. I'm not sure who did it with him, and he spoke about the best reaction that someone gave him was, gosh, I'm going to paraphrase this now to the hilt. I think either childminder or someone kind of close to the family, and when they told her, she just went, fuck. And he just went, that is perfect. Because what else do you say? What else can you say in such a horrendous situation? And sometimes that's what I want people to go, fuck. I don't want people to say, oh, but like, you can have a rich life if you don't have kids. And I'm going, all right. And is this before or after you go home to your three kids? You know, it's not about hating what people have, but it's go, I just like, give me the space to feel this.
Mm.
Give me the space.
I feel like, I don't know, do people just don't want to deal with, they just don't want to deal with, like, I can't deal with your problem. So can you just not, let me just put a plaster on it and fix it there. I'll fix it. And the way I'll fix it is, at least.
Yeah, at least.
At least. At least, because, again.
Sure, don't you have your book? Isn't your book your baby? Yeah, no, kind of, but not really. I don't think I'll do Santa for my book this year, but yeah, my book's kind of my baby. You know, there's plenty of ridiculous at least.
And the parallel is there all the time, as I keep saying, is grief is, inverted commas, allowed openly for anyone who loses a person, a human, and we sit with them and we allow that a lot more. But even still, someone who has experienced a death, even still, you will have, at least you have another child for someone who's lost a child, which is bonkers. I had it myself. I miscarried and someone said, at least you could get pregnant. At least. And I'm like, that's insane to say those things. But then again, it's the lack of space for infertility, which is a loss. A huge valid loss that is not recognized. And how crippling that must be.
Yeah. And yeah, it is. It's complete, like, so maybe I could explain what, because we've done a couple of rounds of IVF, so maybe I can explain briefly what IVF actually looks like.
I was hoping to do that actually. I wanted to ask, because some people don't even understand what it is.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have. Unfortunately, now I speak fluent IVF and I really wish I didn't. I really wish I didn't get it. So, you know, you'll have your consultant, chances are by the time you've reached a clinic, you'll have done a battery of tests and they're just as invasive as you'd imagine. And you'll also spend easily $2,000, easily.
On tests?
Yep. So this is before you've hit a clinic. You arrive at the clinic, you get your appointment, you send over your scans, your blood test, semen analysis, the whole kit and caboodle. So you go into the consultant's office and 10 to 15 minutes and they decide what will be the best, you know, procedure for you or the best way forward. Then you meet with accounts and that's the fun part. And you get your idea of how much it's going to cost. And, you know, we've had a couple of scenarios where we're told, yeah, like it'll take you minimum 3 rounds and you're looking at maybe 8% chance. So obviously you're going 3 rounds multiplied by 8,000. You know, you're doing all this in your head. And then, you know, you decide to go ahead with whatever clinic and you pick a consultant if they're a little bit more. Well, we picked a consultant that was a little bit more human and compassionate. It took us a while to get to that person. So anyway, you go on. So the woman or the person who's going to go through IVF will take some form of estrogen, and so this is that they can control when you'll start your bleed, because things start from day one or day two. Then you'll start with what are called stimulation drugs or stim drugs, which are for, I suppose, what I would have considered IVF, those injections. And for anyone who's just about to start IVF and is worried, I am a fainter historically with needles. The injections are totally fine.
Okay.
Absolutely fine. That was something that I had a big fear about. They're grand. Mm-hmm. So you do them for a number of days. Chances are you might have a baseline scan. They'll bring you in again to check probably around day 7. You'll take a second injection in the morning. That's to stop you ovulating naturally, so that they can let the follicles grow. I was monitored quite regularly. And then typically you'll be given an injection to trigger ovulation. Shortly after that, they will collect the egg. So egg collection, then they're mixed with the semen. I'm sure there's a far more technical term than that. Made into embryos. Then the embryos have to, I think you wait to see how many survive, I think, around after 5 days. And then you do a fresh transfer or a frozen transfer. We never got as far as egg retrieval. So I can speak a lot more clearly about anything up to there, but after that, I don't really know. I haven't experienced it. So, like, there is a full process. So if we're going back to grief, you know, I don't think it's where our country needs to be, but there's slightly more recognition for miscarriage, slightly, and obviously, we both know Sheila, and she did like an incredible program about it, which was spoken about at a conference on Wednesday, and it still holds so much power and impact. So I think that's moving in the direction with a long way to go. So, you know, that might be miscarriage. But then what about the loss of an embryo not implanting? So during a transfer, that's another phase of loss, but there isn't really a name for that. And then, you know, going back further, that loss of embryos not surviving or not having any embryos to begin with. So, you know, if all these aren't recognized, we didn't even get the feckin' eggs. So there's definitely not a category for me. You know, yeah.
What do you do with that pain?
I don't know where to even go with that, you know. And it's this sensation of, oh my God, we fell at the first hurdle. Like, this wasn't supposed to be the hard part. The hard part was flagged, and that was like much further down the road. We fell here. It is a sensation of reeling, because it's really hard to know how to move forward. And, you know, a death hasn't occurred, but there is this heaviness. And, you know, kind of coming back to this idea of being, I don't think it's actively silenced, as you said, as you identified. I think it is more silence out of discomfort. So if someone, like, you know, and what has been said to me was, well, sure, you can just go again. And you're going, yeah, no, I can. What you're asking me to do, it's like, it's a really big process. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of side effects. It's a lot of life on hold. It's a lot of stress, trauma, so on and so forth. So it's not as simple as just ordering another round from the bar.
But it's about not being with you in that moment there again.
No. Of course not.
Skip on.
I did have someone say, gosh, that sounds like a pain in the bum. And I...
Oh my God.
I just stood there.
That's really sad.
And I went, yeah, that's one way to put it.
So flippant.
Yeah, and again, this person is possibly one of the kindest people I know and the most caring. But I do recognise the not knowing what to say. And maybe this is the same with grief when you've lost someone you loved. Maybe there is a wish or a desire not to upset the person. So if they said, oh my God, you must be floored, then maybe I'll cry and fall to bits. Or maybe I wouldn't. Or maybe that's what I needed. I don't know. But it is actually a delicate dance.
It's the same thing, though. It's that's what I'm saying. It is the same thing. You belong in this space beside me.
Yeah.
You really do. Because it is the same thing. It's whether that person just didn't care, which is doubtful, whether that person just didn't have the words, whether they were worried that they would upset you. Either way, it's all about not being able to hold the space. And it's really sad to think that no matter what the loss or the grief is, that's not fun. That's not, you know, any human can recognize that it's not something to be flippant and go, oh, wow, that's shit, isn't it? It's like it's there's a lack of compassion and care. But it do seems it's more readily available to people who, I suppose because so many people openly speak about it's again, it's about the silence.
Yeah.
Openly speak about death and loss and in that sense. But if you don't hear it and you can't see it and you can't recognize it, like as you said, you shared this on social media and hundreds. Right. And I know because I do get it in the Grief Ireland inbox. Have you anybody? You were one of the people, but you were certainly not the first to ask me. And where do you go with that? You know, it's if people don't speak about it, there's a real lack of understanding and therefore silence.
Yeah.
And more than what you just said, Sheila did unreal work bringing miscarriage to the forefront. But unfortunately, we're still there when it comes to infertility or subfertility.
Subfertility, yeah.
As you tune into today's meaningful conversation, we at Counselling Online are so delighted to support and sponsor Grief Ireland. Grief is a complex emotion and we all cope in our own ways. If you find yourself seeking a safe, confidential space to share and explore your feelings, Counselling Online is quietly here for you. Our motto is, wherever you are, we are. Should you feel like reaching out, we are only a click away. www.counsellingonline.ie. Take your time and be well.
Would you at this moment explain to me what subfertility means?
I don't know. I'm looking around because I'm afraid Helena Tuberty is just going to come in and give me a clip my ear. And so Helena Tuberty is this phenomenal lady.
Guru.
Woman. She is a guru. And she's so generous with her expertise. And my gosh, she has a lot of it. So Helena is a fertility specialist, a psychotherapist. She was a midwife. You know, her CV alone is pretty exceptional. And I spoke with Helena in this kind of, you know, when you talk to someone and you just get so excited, like we were leapfrogging over one another. We were talking at one another because we'd so much in common. We just wanted to almost like throw it all on the table at one time. She just like, it's like talking to her was like throwing a match onto kindling. It just set something on fire. It was so exciting. So, you know, she then in a podcast again with Sheila spoke about, you know, language, and she doesn't like the use of the word infertility and would lean towards subfertility. I had been screaming infertility all over my page for 4 days at that point because a lot of the resources that I had been, you know, going back to were American based, and they used the word, you know, infertility a lot. So it she's challenged me to start changing my language so I can get on board with mm-hmm. subfertility for mm-hmm. the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
yeah, so I'm trying to redirect that somewhat.
I know we're not going to really get into specifics and stuff, but you're mm. still in that process of the IVF yeah. world.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you say, the financial strain and things mm. like that is huge. God almighty, it's huge. I imagine it puts a huge strain on a relationship too.
Without a doubt.
Not just financially, but also, again, we're going back to the word grief all mm. the time here, because that's kind of what we're keeping in mind. I imagine you both grieve in a different way.
Yeah.
Your loss feels different
yeah.
in different ways.
Yeah. And I process by talking.
Mm.
My husband processes by being quiet. So obviously he's the one that's doing it wrong. I want to tell him to grieve properly, like me, have all the emotions. Yeah, like it's really, I don't know if polarizing is the right word, but yeah, you can feel very far away from your partner, and ultimately they're the only one who knows exactly what you're going through. And in some ways, I think it is harder on the person that isn't doing the treatment
mm.
in some ways. Like I mentioned, I've had really severe reactions to a lot of the drugs. And Booty has just felt helpless. And in a way, I feel so sick that I don't care. That I'm out of it. I just don't care. I just need this to be fixed. We spent, you know, lots of times in A&E in Hollow Street, you know, calling the consultant down the clinic. You know, there was a real kind of panic. But, you know, now those moments are really blurry to me. But he remembers them very clearly. And that helplessness, I think, must be so, so, so hard to deal with. I can't bear the thought of it being the other way around, to be honest with you. So I can only imagine what it's been like for him.
Mm.
And, you know, going back to, you know, yeah, so we are in the thick of things. And once I invited myself onto the podcast, I also then had to have a think because, you know, there is this saying, you know, speak from the scar, not from the wound. And like, our wound hasn't even had a chance to scab at this point, and it's going to be opened up again, you know. So I did kind of wonder, but I also think it's really important to hear from someone in the messy, messy middle.
Mm-hmm.
Very often when we do hear stories of people who've been through IVF or who have dealt with, let's correct and call subfertility. Helena will give me a little gold star.
Sorry, Helena.
So like when we hear those stories, chances are they're only shared with a little baby in their arms. So, you know, the perception is they went through IVF. But look, there's a baby. And now, if someone says that to me, I hear, see all the nuances of that journey. And I can't see it all. I can't even imagine. Everyone's experience is different. But I now just don't go, you know, broad stroke IVF, baby. Because also a really common misconception is that IVF is a silver bullet. Actually, the statistics are really, really low. So I kind of wanted to give a voice to the thousands of women out there who maybe on the other side of their IVF journey, they said, you know what, enough's enough. It is so much for a body and mind and bank account and relationship to go through. And they went, you know what, we're out. We are out. And they've come to terms with that decision, and there isn't a baby. But all that bit in between has been glossed over, and that's just the couple that just don't have children. Because they like to travel, you know, it kind of gets, you know, grouped into some sort of easy to explain box.
Career.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I kind of, I wanted to speak for anyone else who is in this messy, shitty stage because that's what I need to hear of the not knowing. You know, anyone that you do open up to will tell you, oh, sure, it'll all be grand and sure, please God, now this time next year you'll have a baby in your arms. You know, that happy ending, tendency to happy ending, when it doesn't always work that way. And again, I am going to reference Helena. We have a disagreement about the word hope. I think hope is probably the most intimate part of this journey. It's what I won't talk about. I only will talk about that to Bodhi at night when it's dark and we're in that little tent of you know, being in bed and intimacy and darkness. And I think people are so flippant with hope and, you know, this, please God, it'll work for you. Again, well-intentioned. I prefer the word acceptance because it's uncertain. I don't know if this is, you know, and this is my journey to motherhood. So the journey part is really important, like most things, whether I get there or not. Not that it's irrelevant, but this is a really important part of my life, of my husband's life, our life as a couple. You know, where it ends up, you know, I don't know. I don't know that at this point, and I don't know how far down the road we're going to venture. But I want us to get there together. I want us to be intact mentally, emotionally. So it feels more productive to talk about or to cultivate acceptance that there will be hard times, there will be tough decisions, there will be joyous moments in each outcome. Yeah.
It almost feels like as well, like you, to survive this, you really need to be present, as in stay in the present moment, because you can't really... You can't predict the outcome. You don't know.
No.
And you kind of have to stay present to keep yourself well.
Which is really hard to do. And again, obviously this is a podcast about grief, but no different to another form of grief or grief for a different reason. It's really hard to do day-to-day life. And don't get me wrong, like I did speak at an event a couple of days ago, and I was buzzed. I loved it. The energy was incredible. But that doesn't mean that 24 hours later, there isn't this weight and this heaviness. So, you know, some days I think, gosh, I feel good today. I will go down for a swim and then I'll go for a coffee. And then 5 minutes into the coffee, I can feel, you know, like my focus or, you know, my vision starting to tunnel a little bit. And I know I'm gone. I know this has been too much for me. And I can't really predict those moments. So more often than not, I don't, not necessarily put myself out there, but I don't attend or I don't whatever, because when those moments happen, I just need to be at home on my couch with Bodhi. That's it. I just need that immediate, safe bubble. So
much of it as well, I would imagine, daily losses. It's probably something that's difficult to talk about, I imagine, but do you feel like you get left out of things because you don't have a child? Is there a certain element where you're not included in conversations? Maybe you want to be included in conversations, but because, is there people that tiptoe around you because of this?
Yeah and no. Like my friends, some are younger, some are older. My sisters are younger. They all have had a family. Like, they all have kids. So, and I was single for quite a long time. So I think I'm kind of used to that. There's no one I know who is my age who is pregnant at the moment. In fact, most of my peers are talking about perimenopause. That's a really hard one, actually, that I find really, really difficult. But, you know, we mentioned this briefly yesterday in a voice note, and I got to thinking, and one thing came to my head, and I'm going to say it all without crying. This is a challenge I'm going to set myself. So I love Christmas. I love Christmas. Always have. You know, I have to put a limit on myself. I can't listen to Christmas FM before December 1st because it's just ridiculous. Because I will have it on 24/7, all the way throughout. Love Christmas. Big Christmas tree, the whole shaboodle. Boody does not love Christmas because he's never had it. He's Muslim. He doesn't really get it. He just sees the stress, the expectations. And I'm like, oh, but you're missing the magic. So, you know, I've explained to him what Santa looks like. And the idea of not creating Santa for someone smashes my heart into smithereens. It's not just, you know, for me, it's for my husband. I want him to show what was really big part of Christmas as a child. You know, my mum and dad were super, you know, we laid out the Christmas cake, slice of Christmas cake, the Guinness, which weirdly my dad likes too, you know, the carrot for Rudolph. And then the next morning, the carrot would be whatever eaten and then fecked over the couch. Like, and we're like, oh, flipping Rudolph, he's a gas lad, isn't he? You know, there's all this kind of charade, pantomime around it that, you know, I could be 18 years old, and you still kind of get into the crack of it all. So the, you know, I kind of wanted to show Booty what that looks like. The what can be the magic, that innocence. And, you know, obviously last year we were just married, and I remember thinking, you know what, I'm going to do Santa for Booty to show him, because he has no template. Because hopefully next year we'll be doing it for a newborn, or definitely the year after that. So I'm going to do it for Booty. Now, we got COVID, so that didn't happen. But then there was always the intention, well, maybe, you know, next year it'll be different. So it's this wanting, this need, this desire to have my husband invest into Christmas the way it means to me, and wanting to pass it on, just like I want to pass on traditions, you know, in his culture that are so rich and so based around family and celebration and food, of course. You know, I want to share both sides. So obviously we're kind of in that slide into Christmas. And when you mentioned that yesterday, it was the first thing that came to my head. It's like, oh, so this won't be the year of doing Santa. Okay. And I don't think next Christmas is going to be the year either. That's a really, really hard one to say it loud.
What does that feel like to you?
Oh, it's a gut punch. It literally just pulls the air from my lungs. It's a gut punch. Because Christmas is for kids. And, you know, in a lot of the feedback I got online, was a really interesting one around other kids. So whether that's nieces and nephews or friends' kids, if they're triggering. For me, they're not. For whatever reason, and I'm glad of that, because I adore my nieces and nephews. Bear in mind, there's a 4-week-old in our family, and my sister is also pregnant. So it's definitely challenging, but I also get a kick out of the kids. But I won't lie, there are definitely stark moments of I might not be able to contribute to that. Yeah, and obviously the Christmas one, it's a really... Yeah, it takes the wind from you, for sure.
Yeah. Something that strikes me when I talk to you there, I hope you don't mind me being honest.
Go for it.
When you mention Christmas, and I'm a devil for giving out to people if they say, I'm not going to cry, because I'm like, why? Why would you stop the tears? Would you not laugh? Would you not say, So this is what I preach. I go, you know, if I notice when people apologize for crying, or they say, oh God, I'm sorry. And I always find it bizarre. Now, I still do it because it's ingrained into me. I do it myself. But I keep highlighting that like, you would never apologize for laughing, or never try to stop yourself laughing. Yeah. So I was always listening to you. I understand as well. But I kind of feel like perhaps it's falls into the anticipatory grief bracket.
Yeah.
Because you haven't reached an end destination, as you said. So sometimes I feel like perhaps your grief has to be pulled back and put and held.
Yeah.
Because I can almost
familiar to me.
Yeah. I feel like when I listen to you there, you can see the grief, you can touch the grief, but you also have to hold on for a moment because you're not fully, you know, and it's that's the thing, because you're stuck in it. And in some ways, you of course are grieving, but the outcome is uncertain. And you do remind me when my sister was dying and you know, I knew she was probably going to die, but I wasn't certain either, but more than likely she was going to. The odds were stacked against her, and I had to envision life without her and start to grieve, but also not grieve, because I had the people and, she'll get through that. Why wouldn't she make it through it? And it's like, it's so similar. And yet again, that's what I feel when I listen to you there. I just was thinking it's a living grief. It's a daily thing. It's I imagine very anxiety inducing too, because it's just so uncertain. And as you said, it can probably knock you when you least expect it, and you have the waves, and it's just, it's pure grief.
Yeah.
But in a different form. But yeah, it's just, that struck me when I was listening to you there.
When I was thinking about this yesterday, and the reason why I said I'm going to try not to cry, because when I was thinking about it yesterday, I cried. And it's not like a single solitary tear gently flowing on my face. It was messy. It was snotty. I ran out of tissues, had to pick up the bottom of my T-shirt and start to try and mop up my face. It was horrendous. There's still snot splashes, you know, in my car. It's revolting.
I know.
It's like, oh, Jesus, I can't be doing that. But, you know, it is.
I get
you. It's so, like, you know, it's piercing. It is, it's that kind of crying that, you know, I'm afraid of, because it is, it's hard to stop, because it's a dam. And yeah, maybe this ties into the whole, am I allowed grieve? You know, I'm pretty good. And actually, I had an evening of this last night. I just felt slightly out of control with it. You know, it takes your breath away. So it starts to go into physical symptoms. And, you know, I teach breathing for a living, and it's all about the nervous system and, you know, so on. And, you know, the instinct for me anyway is to numb it, whether that's alcohol or food or hours and hours and hours of Netflix. And I was like, okay, no, I can't do that. Okay. So I just got into my car and I drove, and the car drove itself to Greystones, and I stopped at the Cove, which is where I swim, and just roll down the windows and even just listen to the waves. Now, I was in my pajamas, so I couldn't get out. But, you know, it's just trying to start to regulate a little bit more, because, maybe it's that thing of, if you, I know there's a phrase for it, which is kind of, it's gone from my brain at the moment. But again, if you don't give something space, it will demand it. And last night, it demanded it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 5-hour roller coaster. And obviously, maybe letting it out, you know, in a small manageable bite-sized chunks might be a little bit more effective. But it is that thing of, you know, why are you so upset? I don't know the answer for that. You know, there isn't.
It's not concrete.
Yeah, but if someone had passed, why is she crying? Well, actually, this is what she's been through. You know, it's not comparing, but again, there's a space or an understanding that I just feel is missing. And the knock-on effect of that compounds something that is already pretty traumatic. Can be pretty dramatic.
Yeah, it's very hard to sit in.
Yeah, it really, really is.
It's a hard thing to sit in, so therefore you probably just can't sit in it for too long as well, because that's it just feels like it's there's a lot of fluidity too. It's constantly moving, and you're not done with phone calls from clinics. You're not done with that. Just going back a little bit as well to what you were saying about why you like to speak about it. Because I really feel, I agree with you, you, all I know about IVF is exactly as you said, IVF, IVF, baby.
Yeah.
And we have been going through past tense. Mm. I don't know. I can't say I've ever really heard someone speak openly about, I had, you know, I struggled with subfertility. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Helena. I struggled with subfertility and we never had children.
Yeah.
I don't know that story. Never heard that story. Never bought that newspaper. No. Never happened. Which is, there's a space for everything and everyone. And that's why I really commend you for speaking about the reality of what's going on. And as you said, you don't know the outcome. One thing I wanted to perhaps mention also is I would imagine that, I don't know what your self-image, body, all of that, but I imagine, is there a lot of anguish towards yourself? As in, yeah. I hear that where people say, I feel like my body is failing me. Mm. So is there a big wrestle between your relationship with yourself?
I think at the moment there's a huge sense of loss.
Yeah.
Huge sense of loss. And it's so dense, you know, God, couldn't begin to unpick it. But, you know, I turned 40 last November, so I'm coming up to 41. And in terms of reproductive years, you know, it doesn't look good, or, you know, time's not on your side. This kind of gets repeated to you again and again. And turning 40 wasn't particularly a big deal to me. I was just about to get married. I was doing edits on my book that was to come out. So it was a really exciting, busy, hectic time. Turning 40, cool, let's go. Let's move this along. You know, there's was a lot going on. And it's funny, I'm more nervous about 41 because of what it stands for, or, you know, what it might stand for. So there is that. There's a sense of a loss of youth. And that, like, that would be oversimplifying, and I'm still probably getting it arseways. But there's definitely something about looking at your relationship. I'm not a young woman anymore. I think the easiest way to summarize it is, my friends are talking about perimenopause, I'm trying to have a baby. There's something so clashing about that. And there is a real juxtaposition between the two. So that's kind of one little bundle. There's also something about, you know, your relationship, you know, with your physical body, or this idea of, you know, your body being somewhat a sexual thing. And, you know, if you talk to any woman about having ovulation sex, they'll roll their eyes and go, Jesus, there's nothing worse. And there's nothing worse. You know, it's the
day
most
14.
Unsexy thing ever. It really, really is. But, you know, when you're like, when every second day you're in for a scan and you're stripping off, and like, I laugh at the thought of years ago, anything like that, I'd have to shave my legs, put on a bit of fake tan, make sure, like, what the hell? What did I think I was doing? I'm trying to woo the doctor. You know, like, it is the most, you just become so detached from it. And so used to it becomes normalized. And, you know, a lot of my side effects involved heavy, heavy bleeding. So that's a very graphic and grounding image that it's just, I don't know. It's so at odds with putting on makeup, of wearing jeans and trying to present yourself to the world in a somewhat presentable manner. You just feel, or I just felt so predominantly, like, an experience of being a woman, one that I would probably have associated with giving birth. There's something so primal, and our bodies are meant to do it, and it's incredible how the body adapts and what women can handle. Like, women are just phenomenal, and I felt like I was going through a version of this, but without a baby, or without being pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there ain't no space for this. And it kind of actually ties in with why I decided to put something up on social media. I had an idea in my head to share, and I had to sit with it for a while, and I sat with it for weeks, and we'd already agreed to have this conversation. And then I was speaking at an event in Tipperary and I was supposed to drive down the day before and I couldn't. I was so ill. I was bleeding heavily. We didn't know what to do. So Booty said, well, look, I'll drive you down the next day. We'll time your painkillers so that you can get up and do the talk. I'll put, bring towels. You can sit on towels. I'll bring a change of trousers, you know. So we were managing all this. And, you know, you and your husband, you like, we felt like we were in the trenches here. Like there's no privacy at that point. We're just trying to deal with something. And then I remember the organisers greeting us and they were so lovely and welcoming. And then I had to run to the bathroom and, you know, take painkillers so that I'd be somewhat functional for the next hour. And as it happened, it was a really exceptional event and it was really, really lovely. Then we got into the car and then we pulled over and had to change trousers and lay out another towel. And I just thought, this is so fucking bonkers. Like, this is bonkers. So people have met me for the first time and have this image of whatever they came away with. Hopefully they enjoy the talk and so on. But it was such a stark moment of Instagram versus reality. And I just thought, this is insane. And my kind of favorite word is congruence. And at that moment or on that day, I felt there was such a disconnect of what I was putting forward and what was going on. Mm. I don't think you have to share everything.
Mm.
I probably do, just because I'm an overshare. Like, you don't have to share everything, Claire. But at that moment, it just felt so far apart. I needed to reconcile them somewhat. So when Booty was driving me home, I was kind of dozing, was kind of a bit out of it. And I just said, I think I'm going to share some of this. And he said, some what exactly? And I said, no, just even the IVF thing. And we spoke about what, and we spoke about in what way. I said, I need to bridge that gap somewhat. And like I said, it was to bring those two parts of what was going on behind the scenes and what I was putting out there, to bring them a bit further together. But also, it kind of felt like a kicking down the door and just arriving into a room and presenting two fingers. Mm. Just going, you know what? Fuck all this. I don't know who I'm saying fuck this to. Possibly myself. Fuck all this. This is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I feel about this. It felt empowering, kind of empowering, certainly me reclaiming my sense of autonomy, of just going, hey, I'm a 40-year-old woman, I can talk about this. Because up to that point, it had felt really, really diminishing.
Mm.
Really diminishing. And that's probably another word that jumps out about how you feel about yourself, your body, your identity, your capabilities. And the thing about self-esteem or self-belief, it doesn't stay in this one container, it spills. So it affects everything. It doesn't just stay, okay, can Claire have a baby? Well, it still remains to be seen. But it doesn't stay in this container. Sure, it slops out. And it affects, can Claire do her work effectively? Is Claire a good person? Can Claire actually write? Who cares? You know, it affects.
Is Claire equal
everything.
To other women?
Exactly. It is so, so diminishing. And I know we're chatting away here, but a good example was, I was around the kitchen table in my family home. And I said, I'm going to go away to a podcast. Now, this is a few weeks ago, just before the original conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, brilliant. What's the podcast about? And then I went, I don't know. And then, like, they're just looking at me. What do you mean you don't know? And I'm like, yeah, no, I don't know. I probably have to do my homework a bit better. I haven't, you know, I'm going, why am I not saying this? Mm. It's about grief. It's about grief surrounding infertility and the loss that I just couldn't. And I turned.
Because again, you didn't think you were allowed.
I didn't think I was allowed. And I turned into this simpering, haven't done my homework. I don't know, it wouldn't even be fair to call her a teenager. I turned into this version of myself that I was rolling my eyes at. And me sharing was kind of going, yeah, enough of that. Now that's bollocks. I don't want to be that person, that diminished, simpering. They're the words that are coming up in my brain. I just want to go, you know what? 40 years old. Let's talk.
Mm.
Fuck it.
Just fuck it.
Yeah.
Fuck the lot of you.
Do you have a bleep button? I feel like it's going to be used a lot. Claire Bleep Walsh.
Yeah, there's just so much in what you're saying. It almost it feels like when you talk there, it feels like you become nearly like, I don't know, it just feels like you're on a conveyor belt, and like these are the words that were coming to my mind, like factory, and you come up here and we will prod you and do this and do that and do the other, and like the physical side effects of that and how hard that is, but you must also not talk about it because no one wants to hear about that, and it, like how you haven't blown from not being able to share it. Like,
did I not mention the snot on my window? I think that's fairly clear that I did.
But it is, it's really what it comes down to then is, you know, there's no fixing it. There's no need for anyone to try to say, you know, let's keep the bright side out and keep the faith and keep the hope. And it's just, it is what it is. And it's shit.
Yeah.
It's absolutely shit. End of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like it is that case of what can you say? So either put on the kettle and sit with me on my bloodstained towel or feck off. Mm. You know, there is that, like I'm living in such a stark reality. You know, I can't. I'm finding pretending or putting on the mask quite difficult. So unless you can meet me at where I'm at, and realistically where I'm at, it's really fucking messy.
Mm.
So unless you can come here, then that's okay. I'll see you in a little while. And that is okay. Mm. But I can't be in another place than just right here.
But you see, you are such an outspoken person. You're like myself. You say it how it is. You say things out. And if you holding that in for too long, I mean, if you parallel both of our lives, my gig is talking about grief and loss. And I talked every corner of my sister's death and loss, and every part that bothered me came out. Because that's who I am. I had to get it out. Some people didn't want to sit with me and listen to it.
Yeah.
Many didn't. But if I didn't, I would have exploded.
Yeah.
I had to do that because that's just who I am. And in some ways I feel like for you it's a bit harder still, because the number of people who do talk about your experience is so little and so few. But you were never going to hold that in. You were always going to say enough of this shit. You did to a point. But do you feel a bit of freedom, a bit, even since you spoke about it on Instagram and stuff, did you feel a lightness? Like,
Lightness probably not, and I really dislike the word empowerment because I feel it's so overused.
Mm.
But there was a let's call it reclaiming of autonomy.
You took
it's like
your,
I just was as me, as your me voice again, and it's that thing of kind of stepping into to who you are and what's going on for you, and owning it, as opposed to me googling grief. Am I allowed to be in there? You know. They're two very different versions of me, and kind of, as you well know, they can all coexist, you know, emotions contrasting can coexist. And I felt like there were lots and lots and lots of different versions of me kind of all fighting for attention, where someone had to stand up and go, right, you all sit down. I'll get to you one by one. Someone needed to take the reins. And I'm so glad it's a Claire that's less afraid.
Confident enough.
Yeah. I don't even know if I'd use the word confident. Just, maybe confident or assured.
I mean, confident in your allowance.
Yeah.
Confident enough that, this is a loss. This is an awful time for me. This is trauma that I go through.
Yeah.
And I am allowed to say that.
Yeah.
And to have the confidence to say, yes, I stand in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I need her a bit more often, and you know, she seems to be really busy because she's never really around. You know, I'd be far more quick to default to the, of course I'll do something, or yeah, I'll 100% go over there, as opposed to respecting my boundaries at that time. Of actually, no, this is actually a really tricky week for me physically. I haven't I need to be a little bit more assured or confident or certain in. This is really hard, and harder part of that is we don't know how long this is going to go on for. So we just have to protect ourselves. I have to protect my energy because I still have to work as well. So I really, really need to just pull up the drawbridge a little bit at the moment and protect what is going on, protect and honour what is going on. That's another thing, I think.
Honour
it. Mm-hmm. This is my journey to motherhood. I don't know how long that journey is going to be. And I don't know actually which point will turn off. I don't know. But this is a really important part of my life with my husband. So we have to be present for it in as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, it's really enlightening. It is. It's. Yeah. I'm so glad that you decided to
came
speak.
Up here to curse.
Yeah. Girl, I love a good curse. I love a good curse word. I am so grateful to you for being a voice for so many. And I often find with this line of work that I'm doing now is in what you were searching for. It wasn't out there. And the more people speak and talk about things, you feel less alone, removes the stigma, which when it comes to grief and loss is so important.
Yeah.
And I just actually wanted to say to you that I am so sorry for your losses because I don't know.
Ever said that.
I don't know if anyone would ever have said that. I feel emotional.
Yeah. No one's ever said that.
Yeah. I am very sorry for your loss. And all of
I'm
loss,
in the club.
Yay. You were in the club.
Yeah, that's really, it's a really strange reaction to hear that. It sounds so alien and yet it sounds so perfect at once. That's really a really incredible thing to hear. It's so simple. Mm. I don't know what to say. Then just say that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for coming on
and
being with us here today. And I wish you continued success in your life. And thank you for sharing.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
Claire is a powerful speaker and I really felt she bared her soul with us today, and it's an incredibly courageous and noble thing to do, and I've absolutely no doubt she will have helped so many others feel that they too are allowed to grieve. You can find Claire at Claire Walsh Life on social media, and clairewalshlife.com is her website. As always, it really does help if you spread the word for us to keep these episodes coming to you in the hope that it helps so many of you. The best way is to talk about it, to tell people, to share it on social media. Whatever you can do to help, it really is appreciated. And I will talk to you all next time.